From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Hurricane Michael, now a tropical storm, slams the U.S. Gulf Coast, leaving unfathomable destruction and multiple deaths across the Florida Panhandle and the Deep South.
Total devastation.
You could tell it was something major.
You know, our lives, everything we have is gone now.
It's leveled.
It's sort of just hard to realize just what just happened.
Trust me, this is something that you never want to go through.
Justice Brett Kavanaugh takes his seat on the Supreme Court. President Trump held an informal ceremony at the White House, at which he made controversial remarks.
On behalf of our nation, I want to apologize to Brett and the entire Kavanaugh family for the terrible pain and suffering you have been forced to endure.
You can join us on air or online for our weekly news roundtable. Now that Judge Brett Kavanaugh is Justice Kavanaugh, how do you think about the Supreme Court? What should we do about that dire UN climate report? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook, Fitter and Twacebook, I guess, at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Alexis Simondinger, national political correspondent for The Hill. Alexis, welcome back to On Point.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And also joining us from Washington is Tolu Olorunipa. He is the White House correspondent for Bloomberg. Tolu, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, David.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Alexis, and Tolu.
I want to first turn to a subject that's getting a lot of attention, not just in Washington, but overseas. A Saudi journalist and dissident disappeared in Turkey last week. His name is Jamal Khashoggi. He disappeared, and Turkish authorities say that they believe that essentially a team of Saudi agents killed him and took him out there. Khashoggi joined On Point last November, and in that interview, he criticized Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's tactics for cracking down on corruption within the Saudi government.
One man rule always lead to a disaster. Mohammed bin Salman is doing the right things the wrong way. Saudi Arabia needs fixing, but he need proper advisors around him. He need to expand involving the people in decision making by allowing some form of democracy, some form of power sharing through an elective body. So we have to have that at the near future. Otherwise, one man rule will lead to a disaster.
Now, Khashoggi has been a commentator and columnist for the Washington Post, among other publications, and in Washington circles as well as abroad. His disappearance has been hit very hard. Alexis, walk us through a little bit. How serious an incident is this in terms of having international repercussions?
Well, it looks like it is having significant repercussions, and I would hazard to guess repercussions that the Saudis did not anticipate. It seems clear. In the United States, we're seeing an effort in Congress even to try to press the president, the State Department, and U.S. officials to be much more forceful with the Saudi government to both obtain information and try to press for a full investigation, an accounting of what occurred, as well as an effort in Congress to try to press for sanctions or some form of punishment that might be blocking arms sales. We've heard President Trump say this week that he is not at all disposed to do that, that he considers the Saudis good friends, and in particular Crown Prince bin Salman as an ally and a friend. You remember, it's one of the – I think it's this first foreign trip. It was quite a showy trip that he made there. And around the world, you have seen the British foreign minister immediately call the Saudi ambassador for a discussion about what's going on, and condemnation beyond what I think the Saudis anticipated would happen with a missing journalist.
I mean, the human elements of this are rending. He goes into the Saudi consulate in Istanbul essentially to get documents that he needs to be able to marry his fiancée. She waits for hours outside. He never reemerges. Saudi authorities say, gosh, they're concerned and would like to know what happened too and would be happy to help figure it out. But there's no videotape showing him ever leaving the consulate in Istanbul. Tolu, talk to me a little bit about the relationship that the Trump administration has had with the Saudis, with the Crown Prince, and also about the tenor of the president's reaction in the days following Khashoggi's disappearance.
Yeah, it's been a very close relationship, specifically between President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and the Deputy Crown Prince, Bin Salman. They've spent a lot of time together. Jared Kushner has spent time going over to Saudi Arabia and having sort of personal talks. There have been reports that Kushner and Bin Salman have had talks outside of the normal chain of command without alerting the intelligence community. So there is that sort of close, informal relationship that they have, and that has led to a disconnect between what you're hearing from the traditional foreign policy establishment in Washington, including several members of the Senate who are calling for more information. They're calling for tough action by the Trump administration to get to the bottom of what happened versus what you're hearing from the president. And I was in the Oval Office yesterday during one of these pool sprays where the president brings in reporters and talks to them for a few minutes. And he was saying that he would tell senators directly to their face that he does not agree that there should be sanctions that would block any arms sales to the Saudis because—
Well, and so— And Tolu, yeah. let me play that, because in the Oval Office we have a clip of the president talking, and he said, you know, he's unhappy that Khashoggi may have been taken, abducted, may have been killed, but wasn't certain how he wanted to address it.
This took place in Turkey, and to the best of our knowledge, Khashoggi is not a United States citizen. Is that right? Or
permanent
is that
resident. Right?
He's a permanent resident. Okay. We don't like it, John. We don't like it, and we don't like it even a little bit. But as to whether or not we should stop $110 billion from being spent in this country, knowing they have four or five alternatives, two very good alternatives, that would not be acceptable to me.
And let's be clear, that $110 billion that President Trump was referring to right there involved a major arms deal with the Saudi Arabia that the president proposed last year. Tolu, you know, my understanding was that Saudi Arabia in some ways and the Crown Prince formed the linchpin of what had been sort of these nascent efforts at creating a peace deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and they're sort of planning for the Middle East. How important is Saudi Arabia to their conception of what happens over there?
Yeah, as I mentioned, Jared Kushner earlier, he's also tasked with putting together a peace plan for the Middle East, despite not having a lot of foreign policy experience in the past, being a relatively young guy. And he has called for Saudi Arabia to be a key partner in that. And as President Trump's administration has tried to put together its Middle East policy, a lot of it has been sort of antagonistic towards Iran. And in doing so, they have relied on the Saudis, who have a long-running feud with the Iranians, to partner with the U.S. and to try to put pressure on Iran and try to drive the Iranians out of various places in the Middle East where they have shown some influence over the past few years, including in Yemen. So yeah. the Saudis are key to the Trump foreign policy in the Middle East, and it's not yet clear what this current incident is going to do to that foreign policy arrangement.
Yemen, of course, a circumstance in which the Saudis are coming under a lot of attack for the killing of civilians in the conflict there. It's worth pointing out the Turks are playing an interesting role here. They're both supplying, it seems, the U.S. with information about what may have occurred in the consulate there in Istanbul. But also today, a Turkish court ordered the release of an American pastor named Andrew Brunson, who'd been held, I think, for the last couple of years on terrorist charges. Jack Beatty, I want to turn back to you to talk a little bit about what this means in terms of the standing of journalism right now. It took the president basically a week to address this in a way that was critical, possibly, of his Saudi friends. What does it say about the standing of journalism? Washington Post columnist and commentator vanishes in a Saudi consulate.
Well, of course, the president is well known for his attacks on the press, enemy of the people and the like. And is that has he in effect sowed a climate of opinion where people feel they can do almost anything to journalists? That's a reach, but he certainly has contributed to it. What I was struck with in that tape we just in that sound we just ran was the it illustrated the point that Anonymous made in his Times op-ed, the secret high level person in the administration. He said that the president was, quote, amoral, without values, without discernible values. And there we saw it in his equivocation. Well, the fellow was from, it happened in Turkey, wasn't really a U.S. citizen. And then in the invocation of this phantom arms sale, there's only a statement of intent, as I see it, as I've read, and then the invocation of phantom competition. According to experts, no one is in competition with us, since all the vested arms systems the Saudis have are American. They can only buy American. And you know, why? Why would the president react this way? Partly, of course, he has conflicts of interest. He has multiple arrangements.
Or at least business interests on this, yeah.
Yes, yes. And even in his hotels over here. And, of course, his crown prince, Kushner, has various connections there. And, you know, we read in The Intercept, interestingly, that Kushner gave names of disloyal Saudi family members to his opposite number, the MBS in Saudi Arabia, and he got the names from the president's intel report. I don't know whether that's true or not. That is reported in The Intercept, but it mm-hmm. shows a level of involvement with Saudi Arabia that's sinister.
Alex Simmendinger, in the 45 seconds we have left before this break, you know, give me a feel for the degree to which you sense an openness in the at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, not the Hill, to really challenge the ties that they've been trying to forge with Saudi over something like this?
That's a really interesting question, because the administration out of the White House is not speaking with one voice. We've been focusing on what President Trump has not been saying, but we have seen the vice president step forward relatively quickly, and we've seen Secretary of State step forward with a more forceful reaction to what was suspected to have occurred. And then with the Washington Post coverage that we saw last night, with the Turkish intelligence sharing with the United States, we've seen mm-hmm. that the intelligence community is trying to press the president's hand.
Well, Simmendinger, Folkenflik, Beattie, Olurunipa, you know, you've come for the political analysis, stay for the Scrabble stories. We're talking about the week's top stories. What do you expect from the court now that Brett Kavanaugh has taken his seat at the Supreme Court? What about Kanye West in the West Wing? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're looking at the week in the news. You can join the conversation. Kanye West in the Oval Office. President Trump says that was quite something. That something included an F-bomb in front of the press pool. What about that devastating climate report from the UN? And after the market jitters, does that affect how you feel about the economy? Should it? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Bloomberg White House correspondent Tolu Olurunipa, The Hill's national political correspondent Alexis Simmendinger, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. I also want to remind listeners that we are tracking what's going on with Tropical Storm Michael, and you can find news of that all day and all weekend on NPR's broadcasts and also online at npr.org. I do want to turn to the climate report done by the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change commissioned by the United Nations, which had very stark conclusions about the world's climate, where it was headed, and what kinds of actions were needed to even just mitigate damage. During an interview with On Point on Tuesday, Drew Schindel, a Duke University climate scientist and one of the co-authors of the report, explained that past climate change models have been, if anything, much too conservative, and that we are seeing the results of not changing our habits quickly enough.
We've seen hurricanes hold more water. We've seen coastal areas get flooded. We've seen the occurrence of heat extremes go up. So we're not just relying on these models. We're actually seeing that the models have, if anything, been kind of too conservative. And we're now reaching areas of dangerous and damaging impacts more quickly than we realized we would back in the 80s.
Tolu Olurunipa, how is the government responding to this panel, this report?
Without much action, actually, if you're looking specifically at the White House, which drives much of the policy in the federal government, there's not a lot of action that's being taken to combat this fast-moving problem of climate change. We've seen the president, you know, try to talk about how climate change is a hoax. He said that in the past. And his administration has rolled back a lot of the regulations that were put in place by the previous administration to try to get ahead of this issue. We did see the president pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement last year, saying that it was not fair to the United States. It's an agreement that basically all of the countries in the world agreed to in order to try to slow the impact and the onset of climate change. This is a president that really wants to focus more on, you know, reducing regulations, investing in traditional forms of energy, and, as he says, putting coal miners back to work. And he hasn't spent as much time focusing on these very dire warnings that we're getting from scientists about what will happen if action isn't taken to slow the impact of climate change on the planet.
I'd like to take a call now from West Brookfield, Massachusetts. I believe it's Bob. Bob, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I think the biggest driver of climate change is the denial by people in their everyday lives who turn away from it. There's no bigger issue. And if this report does anything, it tells me that people who claim to say that they will do anything to protect their families, protect their children, they really are not telling the truth unless they get engaged and are willing to start seeing those changes and pushing and forcing those changes from the bottom up, because it ain't going to happen from the top down.
Thanks so much for that call, Bob. Alexis, I asked Tolu what action had been taken at the White House. What kind of just reaction has there been from leaders on the Hill, particularly Republican leaders?
Well, you know, one element of the UN report was borne out immediately in the reaction, as you're questioning. And at the Hill, the news organization I work with, our environmental reporter went to the Hill, went around on Wednesday, was trying to talk to lawmakers who are on the right committees or would normally be interested, and came away writing a story that he couldn't find anybody who had read it. Now, why would that be? That's because we're just a couple of weeks before a midterm elections, and the UN report said that there were very limited options because time is now very, very short to try to have some functional impact on this trend, but that the political will is not there. And that was the reaction that we discovered right away. And as Tolu said, the president has said, you know, oh, there's lots of reports, as if this report is just among hundreds that he is willing to reject or ignore. And so whether it was the White House or Capitol Hill, it was just a big, you know, crickets.
Makes it sound like sort of yet another parking ticket, whereas the issues at stake are quite dire. Indeed, this is an issue, obviously, we hear it on point. We'll continue to coverage. I do want to move on to the swearing in of a new justice on the Supreme Court, one of nine. Brett Kavanaugh appeared at the White House. There was sort of a ceremonial swearing in, that is, he had already been formally sworn in, but he appeared at the White House. And at that time, the newly minted justice, Brett Kavanaugh, assured Americans he would be an independent and impartial justice devoted to equal justice under law and part of the Supreme Court's team of nine.
I was not appointed to serve one party or one interest, but to serve one nation. America's Constitution and laws protect every person of every belief and every background. Every litigant in the Supreme Court can be assured that I will listen to their arguments with respect and an open mind.
Jack Beatty, you've heard the new justice. Can you feel assured that he'll listen to the litigants' arguments with respect and an open mind?
Well, he had to say that, didn't he? Based on his philippic in front of the Senate committee, attacking the Democrats as part of a big conspiracy. And we heard everything except Benghazi come out of his mouth. He was so deeply into Republican paranoia. So, he had to reassure us on that score. But, there's no check on him. Lifetime appointment. He can say what he will. If I might, let me just quickly return to that climate change report, because, you know, it's clear enough the challenge this poses to the GOP, or some people call it the Grand Oil Party, which is deep into purchased denialism. But what about the Democrats? James Hansen, the climate scientist, in a recent paper says either we will go to negative emissions now, basically, or we will have to invest $89 trillion to $500 trillion over the next century just to pull the carbon that's in the atmosphere out, partly through developing as yet unheard of technologies. What does that say to the Democrats when they went to Bernie Sanders, when he says free college for everybody, when he says we need universal health care, when they talk about guaranteed jobs? Where is this money going to come from?
So the cost of
the party.
The cost of keeping true to their rhetoric.
Yes, yes. And yet they want to pose as the part, we're concerned about the climate. If they're concerned about the climate, their agenda has to change to reflect this civilizational crisis.
Alexis Simendinger, is there any sense, going back to the new justice, that thinking about the elections that the Republicans will pay a price for Kavanaugh, or will they? Does it now look as though they'll be a little bit juiced by the enthusiasm of conservatives returning to the fold?
Well, listening to Republican leaders in Washington, as well as some pollsters who are watching these races very carefully, they're suggesting, I'm thinking of Mitch McConnell, who's been doing some victory lap sort of interviews recently, a bunch of them, and they're pointing to polls in which their Senate candidates are pulling ahead or doing better than they thought they might in states that they would normally be thought of to be winning. And Mitch McConnell, the majority leader in the Senate, is eager to say that that little bump he thinks is coming from what happened with Kavanaugh. In fact, as you know, in the NPR interview, he said it happened just at the right time. He thought the timing was just perfect, even though he said it wasn't planned that way to be so contentious right before the election. Democrats have not disputed that. They believe that Democrats are very motivated and might themselves be very motivated about what they saw, particularly women voters. But the Democrats are not disputing that Republicans have perhaps gotten a little bit of a bump. What we don't know is, because we still have a few weeks before November 6th, whether Kavanaugh and everything that happened with it fades as he, you know, is cloaked in his robes and goes behind the Supreme Court bench, and whether the American public focuses on the next controversy or the next bit of news.
Let's get a feel a little bit of how expectations have been raised in the wake of the Kavanaugh, the clashes over Kavanaugh. We have a call from Waterford, Michigan. Tony, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I am outraged that the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee confirmed Brett Kavanaugh as the Supreme Court Justice. First of all, I believe the women. I think that Dr. Christine Blasey Ford was entirely believable, and that Brett Kavanaugh was completely lying.
Pardon? I was just going to say, he's on the court now. Can you at least feel as though you can wait and see how he does?
Pardon?
Can you feel in some ways you can still wait and see how he does as a justice, or are you already feel kind of locked in how you feel about him?
I think, well, first of all, let me finish my point. There were several other women who wanted to testify in front of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, but the committee chairman, U.S. Senator Charles Grassley, and the other Republicans on the committee would not permit anyone other than Dr. Christine Blasey Ford to testify. Aside from that, the women who testified, aside from all the women who testified, I feel that
That's all right. It sounds like we're getting there. We appreciate your call, Tony. Your call, Tony. I appreciate that a lot. Tolu, you know, if expectations are raised by the Democrats that somehow if they take back the House, they should go after Kavanaugh, they should, as our caller in some ways was suggesting, is that likely going to find fertile ground on the Hill?
I think Democrats are trying to tamp down some of the expectations about what they can do if they control even just one House of Congress. They still do not have the presidency. So I think their hands will be full with investigating the Trump administration and the presidency and the executive branch. I don't think that they're going to want to promise voters that they're going to be able to impeach someone from the Supreme Court, because that's not something that would be in their power to do on their own. So I think they're tamping down some of those expectations. But We did hear from House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi earlier this week that she would be willing to get President Trump's tax returns out to the public pretty easily if the Democrats took over the House. So I think they're focusing more on how they're going to be able to provide oversight of the executive branch, something they say Republicans haven't been doing in the first 2 years of the Trump administration, and focusing on the judicial branch, even though there's a lot of passion over Kavanaugh's confirmation is not something that I'm hearing too much from Democrats. Now, they will likely try to do some more investigating if they feel that the FBI investigation and the Republican-led Senate Judiciary Committee investigation was incomplete. But whether or not that could actually lead to some sort of action that could reverse the confirmation of Kavanaugh, it's something that is unlikely, and I think Democrats are trying to set the expectations to let voters know that that's not something that's likely to happen.
David, right, can
so this
I
week,
add
this week,
could I add something say, really
okay,
quick?
Okay, go ahead, Alexis. Yes.
Real quick, last night, I just want to add what Tolu was saying. Last night, the Senate was so eager, Democrats and Republicans, to get out of Washington to go home to campaign, that the Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, was successful in getting voice votes and quick votes last night to approve 15 more judicial nominees last evening and 21 executive branch nominees. So the total for President Trump and the Republicans is 84 judges, lifetime appointments. And that's a record that the president and Mitch McConnell are touting. But you could see that Democrats were not protesting. They did a lot of this by voice vote, and they were eager to get out of Washington.
Well, so you had a major arrival in Brett Kavanaugh. You had a notable departure. Nikki Haley stepped down as the ambassador to the UN. Not exactly clear why she timed it this way. And then you had a notable arrival yesterday in the White House itself. Kanye West showed up, a moment, a spectacle, call it what you will, to meet at the Oval Office with President Trump. During that meeting, the rapper praised the president while wearing a red Make America Great Again hat.
Trump is on his hero's journey right now, and he might not have expected to have a crazy like Kanye West run up and support, but best believe we are going to make America great.
Tolu, you cover the White House. What'd you make of this?
Yeah, that was a wild spectacle. There have been a number of bewildering days in this administration, but that one was pretty crazy. This was a 10-minute, basically a rant by the rapper Kanye West, where he's talking about hydrogen planes and the 13th Amendment and how, you know, putting on the Make America Great Again hat made him feel like Superman. There were some sexist tropes in there, some old tropes about, you know, black people in welfare, and President Trump just sort of sat through it and didn't say anything. And at the end, he said, you know, that was quite something. And Kanye West said he channeled it from his soul and spoke from the heart. And he left, you know, the reporters in the room and all of the American people watching pretty much stunned that this was taking place, not to mention the profanity that was laced throughout his performance. It was pretty a bizarre performance. And I think President Trump does believe that Kanye West will have an impact on helping him gain support among black voters. There's not really any evidence that that's the case, but that's part of the governing style of President Trump. It's just sort of going based on the gut, inviting people that talk positively about him into his orbit and seeing what happens without any kind of script. And yesterday was definitely an example of that.
Jake Beatty, we've got about a minute left before the break. The president invites Kanye West in for pool spray. He sort of calls in to Fox News pretty much every hour on the hour. What's the president up to right now?
Well, I think he's just up to what his inveterate habit, which is to draw attention to himself. I mean, he, you know, one of the problems with Trump scandals is that there are so many of them, or Trump, you know, incompetences or Trump moments, so that one replaces the other, and we're concussed by the sheer volume of things to pay attention to. So what's he up to? Drawing attention to himself and off other things.
We'll be talking about the midterms. We'll be talking about the president's rhetoric. We'll be talking about a lot, all this and a lot more. We are chatting right now about a lively week in the news. We want you to join our conversation. You can do it by phone. You can do it online. You can at me. You can hit me up. President Trump calls Democrats an angry mob. Are his opponents objectionable, or are they just motivated? What about the precipitous drop in the Dow? How are you feeling about the state of your economy? I'm David Folkenflik. And this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik, and I'm talking about the week's top stories with Alexis Simendinger of The Hill, Tolu Olurunipa of Bloomberg, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What other stories are moving you this week? What's on your radar? What's not getting enough coverage? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. One of our callers called to admonish us for spending any time on Kanye West's visit to the White House at all. But I think it's part of a piece of understanding where the president is coming from, what's on his mental landscape, what is he sharing with us. He also had some sharp words at a rally in Council Bluffs, Iowa on Tuesday. The president had harsh words for those who oppose him.
You don't hand matches to an arsonist, and you don't give power to an angry left-wing mob, and that's what the Democrats have become.
We've heard a lot of rhetoric from Republicans about Democrats and their opponents being mobs. Jack Beatty, where's this rhetoric coming from?
Well, yeah, and let's just get a further taste of it. He's called the Democrats evil, the party of crime. They want to destroy our country. Liberals are, quote, very, very bad people. You know, in the October 19th, 2016 debate, President was asked, then candidate Trump was asked, will you abide by the results of the election? And he said, I will look at it at the time. I will keep you in suspense. It could be rigged. Now we have to be in suspense about 2020. Is it likely that the president will turn over power, should the Democrats win, to a party that is, what, destroying our country, very, very evil? You know, we've reached the point where this sort of ultimate alarm is almost common sense about Trump. He is Ed Luce. Well, my heavens, writing in the Financial Times, it's no leap to imagine Trump refusing to accept election defeat.
That's a long step from where we are, but certainly the rhetoric is charged. He's talking about mob rule. Alexis Simendinger, you've been hearing that from congressional figures, some of them on Capitol Hill as well. What are you hearing that's driving that rhetoric? What do they point to, and you know, what is it really grounded on?
Well, first of all, when we first started to hear this discussion about an angry mob, it was a talking point. It was very clear because Republicans, including the president, were all speaking with the same voice. So it had been focus grouped. It was a talking point, and pollsters were suggesting that Republicans would profit by doing this. And part of this is because in an election season, no matter what party you're in, you're trying to draw very sharp contrasts and mobilize your own base to turn out. And we know that Republicans have been very concerned that their base is not as mobilized or as excited about turning out in a midterm election as Democrats may be. So,
Alexis, let me just stop you there to help underscore your point. During On Point's trip to Pennsylvania last weekend, Lehigh Valley resident Dorothy Niklos told my co-host Meghna Chakrabarty that people are getting tired of constant protests from Democrats.
The Democrat Party has gone so far to the left. And I don't know, you will always have a divide there because you're having the patriots versus the socialists and the globalists. And that until people could sit down and discuss things and not have one faction running around with silly pink hats on their heads and signs and everything that goes, I mean, they're everywhere.
And that's from On Point's field reporting from Pennsylvania, in that case, about how congressional redistricting is affecting the state's hotly contested midterm races. You can find more about that on our website, onpointradio.org. But Alexis, to allow you to continue a little bit, you know, is there something more to what they're saying about sort of mobs than simply that people were protesting? I mean, you know, freedom of assembly is a constitutional right. That hardly seems like mob rule to me.
Well, it is, but it sparked a debate about what is our body politic, what is free speech and what is going over the line? And of course, Democrats are furious because they argue that the president himself is very incendiary in his rhetoric and often incites a mob reaction himself. But I would also point out that the Republican efforts to draw a sharp contrast started before Brett Kavanaugh. And you can see when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won her race in New York and defeated Joe Crowley, long-term incumbent, and is running as a socialist, that there were lots of eyebrows raised and hands were being rubbed together in the Republican Party about, wow, we can really use this. Because the effort there is to say that the entire Democratic Party is being pulled to the left, to the left, to the left. And, you know, you can see that there are a variety of candidates who are interested in perhaps running for president or in these House races that fit into a mold that the president and Republicans are using to showcase a kind of activism that they want to paint as going too far.
It's interesting because there's this tension, and it's almost as though they're seen as in parallel, but sounds kind of different to me, about tension about whether to be pulled to the left among Democrats, and you've seen that play out in some congressional primaries and races, and also tension about how strongly to fight for political success. Earlier this week, former Attorney General Eric Holder, who of course served in the Obama administration, spoke at a campaign event for Georgia Democratic gubernatorial candidate Stacey Adams. He referenced Michelle Obama's often repeated comment, "When they go low, we go high." Eric Holder said, "No, when they go low, we kick them. That's what this new Democratic Party is about." He followed up a few minutes later.
"When I say, you know, we kick them, I don't mean we do anything inappropriate. We don't do anything illegal. But we got to be tough. And we got to fight for the very things that John Lewis, Martin Luther King, Whitney Young, you know, all those folks gave to us. That stuff can be taken away. That's what they want to do. They want to maintain power."
That was former Attorney General Eric Holder speaking at a campaign stop for Stacey Abrams in Georgia. A lot of Republicans and conservatives took great offense, Tolu. They said, you know, this is wildly inappropriate. He further clarified his remarks on Twitter saying, "Okay, stop the fake outrage. I'm just saying Democrats need to be tough, proud, and stand up for the values we believe in the end." But the president took this as a bit of a rallying cry.
Yeah, the president did, the RNC did, the leaders of the Republican campaigns for 2018 are all sort of seizing on this comment and other comments that are somewhat similar by Democrats, trying to paint this broader picture that, you know, Democrats are a party that condones and incites violence. And it's a talking point that they're really driving home on in these final weeks of the election because, as Alexis said, both parties see this as a base election where they're trying to motivate their base. There has been evidence that Democrats are incredibly motivated in part by their animus towards the president to turn out in high numbers. And Republicans are trying to match that in part by saying, you know, these Democrats are socialists. They are violent. They are part of Antifa. And, you know, as the president said, they're going to allow crime to come into the country if they take over. So it's part of a political strategy. We'll have to wait and see for the next 3 or 4 weeks if it works, if it does succeed in driving turnout. We did hear from Michelle Obama, who sort of pushed back and said, you know, the politics of fear is not the politics that's going to win over the long term. But there is this debate in the Democratic Party about how hard to push. And they've seen some of the success that President Trump has had and that Republicans have had with hardline tactics like holding open a Supreme Court seat for a year. And they're saying, we want some of that on our side. We want people to really go to the mat for our policies. And there's a debate between that and the idea that we need more civility in our politics. We're going to beat them by going high when they go low. And that internal debate is still playing out. And it's been happening in different ways in different parts of the country. We've seen more moderate Democrats win in some places. We've seen Democratic Socialists and Progressives win in other places. And what's going to happen in November is going to have a big impact on, in determining how the Democrats move forward in 2020 and what kind of party they want to be for the next presidential race.
I'd like to take a call now from Detroit, Michigan. Steve, we've got you. What's on your mind?
Hi, I am calling not with a question, but a comment, a general observation, and that is I've heard on two different NPR talk shows this morning this batting back and forth about Democrats are hysterical because we say that Trump and his administration are fascist-like and authoritarian. It's not an intellectual exercise for me. In the early 1970s, I was stationed in Spain in the Navy when Franco was still alive. So I have lived and worked and experienced a truly fascist nation. I've also worked and lived in Saudi Arabia and experienced a strictly authoritarian culture and society. And we want no part of that. I'm here to tell you, this is an empty rhetoric.
Well, Steve, obviously appreciate your comments. Strong words. You know, in those countries, you probably wouldn't have been able to make a call to a public affairs show like this with such strictures on freedom of expression. You know, there is that tension between inside the Democratic Party about how strongly to denounce the Republican opponents. During an appearance on NBC's Today Show yesterday, Michelle Obama responded to Holder's statement of "When they go low, we kick them." And here's what she said.
Fear is not a it's not a proper motivator. Hope wins out. And if you think about how you want your kids to be raised, how you want them to think about life and their opportunities, do you want them afraid of their neighbors? Do you want them angry? Do you want them vengeful?
Do you want them vengeful? So playing out some of the tensions there within the Democratic Party. We've asked for what's on your mind. Jamestown, New York, we have a caller. Paul is on the air. Paul, what subject do you want to bring some attention to?
Yeah, hi, David. First of all, I'd like to thank you all for the great programming.
Thank you, sir.
We always get a lot of information and get ourselves educated by listening to you guys. So thank you for that. So I'm calling about the matter of a citizenship question on the census rolls. And I heard today, I believe on NPR, I heard today that Steve Bannon may have spoken to Wilbur Ross to bring this subject up. And Wilbur Ross had claimed that the idea for putting that question on the rolls originated, I think he said, in the Justice Department, or it might have been
Justice Department is right.
Security.
That's right.
Yeah. So here it is. Apparently, Wilbur Ross has lied about this, and I'd like to hear what the panel has to say about this.
Let me throw it to them. And thank you so much for raising that. Tolu, you know, take a moment. This involved a question being proposed for the 2020 census about citizenship, and the Commerce Secretary had denied any White House involvement in the inclusion of that question. How does it actually play out?
Yeah, this is a process that's working its way through the courts right now with lawsuits over this very controversial idea of putting a question about citizenship for the first time in several decades on the 2020 census. Now, Wilbur Ross, who leads the Commerce Department, which is running the census, told Congress that he got this instruction basically from the Justice Department that there was no White House involvement. And now he's come out with a new statement saying he remembers actually that Steve Bannon, the former chief strategist within the White House, who has, you know, all of these links to sort of anti-immigration rhetoric from his former website, Breitbart.com, he was the person who basically brought this up in a discussion with Wilbur Ross. So that leads to all sorts of questions about what is the true motive behind putting the citizenship question on the census. If you listen to pro-immigration activists, they say that the idea is to put this question on the census to scare away potentially undocumented people or immigrants and have them not respond to the census, which would reduce their amount of representation and all of the
not
things
be counted.
That Right. They would not be counted in the census, and maybe there would be less representation in Congress and in legislatures. And that is an argument that's being argued out in the court process right now as there are lawsuits trying to get this question off of the census. People in the administration say that, no, they're just trying to get a appropriate count of who's in the country, who's a citizen, and who's not. But it is striking at a very crucial issue in the country right now, which is the immigration issue. And it's something that the current president, President Trump, has been much more of a hardliner on than previous presidents. And that's why it's striking such a chord. And that's why this court case is going to be incredibly important and why this new revelation that Steve Bannon was involved leads more credence to the idea that maybe this does have more of an immigration component to it and not necessarily just sort of a standard. We're trying to get the numbers and try to figure out who's in the country and who's here as a citizen.
As we acknowledge some of the stories occurring this week, the Archbishop of the District of Columbia, Cardinal Worrell, has just submitted his resignation. It has been accepted by Pope Francis, clearly in response to strong questions and criticisms for the way in which the Cardinal handled allegations of abuse by members of the Catholic clergy over the years. Jack Beattie, I want to turn – we've got just a couple minutes left, but I want to turn to the question of the markets this year all over the map, really take a sharp tumble over the last couple of days. To what extent do you think we should think of that as reflecting on the health of the economy at the moment?
Well, I got my prognostication license on the economy from Walmart. I have no idea, but it does show the president's the riskiness of the president's. You know, months ago he was posing in front of the stock market. Look at these great numbers. They're reactions to me. Well, are the current numbers also reactions to him? To his I think feckless and even self-harming trade war with China. Is this about rising interest rates? People fearing that? Who knows? We'll just have to see. It is just so risky of the president to brag about the stock market, and then when it goes down, well, who caused it?
And of course, you know, it's interesting to see him being critical of chairman of the Federal Reserve, whom he installed for the question of increasing interest rates, which can have a break on the stock market, in replacing a Federal Reserve chair who might have been more careful and tentative about doing that. You've just been hearing the voice of Jack Beattie. He's our news analyst here on On Point. Jack, always a pleasure.
Thank you.
We've also been hearing from Tolu Olorunu Nipa, the White House correspondent for Bloomberg. We appreciate your time so much today, Tolu.
Thanks, David.
And Alexis Simmendinger, she's national correspondent for The Hill. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, David.
We can continue the conversation together. You can get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, and Miriam Wasser, with help from Madeline D'Angelo, Justine Daum, and Lexi Peary. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.